So the last panel is American Interest in Eastern Mediterranean Energy, and we really do have a distinguished panel, and I'm so appreciative that you're both here. David Gillers, Senior Counsel on the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources under Ranking Member Maria Cantwell, Democrat, Washington. You've got extensive Hill experience and a lot of experience in the energy side of the House. So, David, thank you for coming. And then next to him is Ben Dillon, Vice President, Communications and Government Relations for Noble Energy. And we've talked a lot about energy, and I can tell you Noble knows it inside and out, as does Ben. And he's got a lot of experience in that field and certainly a lot of experience on the Hill and in government as well. So with that, I'm going to do the same routine we did with the others. I'll turn it over to the speakers. Each one take whatever you need time-wise. When you're done, then we'll do a little back and forth, and we'll turn it over for Q&A. But with that, I'll turn it over to you, David.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. I should just say at the outset, I'm generally not used to this type of microphone. So I feel like I should be breaking out into some kind of country music song.
You need the head, please.
That's right. But I will resist. General Cheney, thank you so much for having me, and Andrew Holland, a special thanks to you for putting this together. It's also an honor to be sitting next to Ben Dillon. I feel like I can say that we're like old friends now. We've been crossing paths on this issue for many years now. And the Chamber of Commerce, who will be joining us shortly, has also done some excellent work on facilitating and representing U.S. commercial interests in the Middle East. I do think that we're at a unique moment in history, and I'll preface it by saying I understand that there's been a lot of discussion of the obstacles to progress in the Eastern Mediterranean and some of the doom and gloom that we do get used to when we talk about regulatory obstacles. But I think it's worth noting that we still are, I think, at a unique moment in history where regional dynamics, market realities, and resource discovery, or recent resource discovery, all coincide to present really enormous potential and enormous opportunities. The title of this panel is American Interest in Eastern Med Energy, but I think it's worth, as a backdrop, to explain what the U.S. government has done until this point. And then to talk about why the U.S. government has been so involved, both, let's say, publicly and behind the scenes. 2011, the U.S. Congress actually led the first ever trade mission, oil and gas trade mission, to Israel, and they took about 15 Louisiana oil and gas companies, and I see that our colleague
Steve
is joining
us
now.
He's here. Thanks,
good to
Steve.
See you.
I'll introduce you following those two, so please have a seat.
Sure. So in 2011, the U.S. Congress, or a member of U.S. Congress, led the first ever oil and gas trade mission to Israel, bringing about 15 Louisiana and Texas oil and gas companies to Israel, followed in 2012 by another trade mission that was facilitated by both the U.S. Department of Commerce and the State Department, as well as members of Congress, this time focused on industry as well as academia. The Department of Energy and the Department of the Interior have provided regulatory consultations for some of the governments in the Eastern Mediterranean. And we have hosted, in the U.S., regulators visiting from those countries who are dealing with natural resources in a very new way and are trying to build the regulatory infrastructure that they just have not had until this point. I think the most exciting participation or involvement of the U.S. government, though, has come not from Congress, and I guess it's odd saying that as I do work there, but the State Department and the administration have really been incredibly engaged on this issue. I'd say not as publicly as the U.S. Congress, and you won't see as many press releases from the State Department, but there are those, and they have public press conferences on this. But I feel like there's a tendency in Congress to issue a press release about anything and everything, even if it is not particularly newsworthy. And the State Department, I think, errs on the other side. But they've been very engaged in facilitating and brokering deals between the Energy Consortium, who were working in both Cyprus and in Israel, and Noble's involved with that, and the Palestinian Authority, Jordan and Egypt. And I think just it is important to point out that the deal that is in process, or they've announced the letter of intent and has been signed between Israel, or between the Energy Consortium and Jordan, is really significant because it would involve building a pipeline between mainland of Israel and Jordan. And this, in fact, would be the first cross-border infrastructure project since the 1994 peace accords between the two countries. And you know, it's unfortunate that until now, that has not been the case, or there have not been cross-border infrastructure projects. But this does present enormous potential. Additionally, the discussions of the pipelines that may be built, that are being discussed to Egypt, if somebody had told me several years ago that that was a reality, I certainly would have laughed. And in fact, I remember reading a report suggesting that that could be one option, and I dismissed it immediately as completely improbable. But it is in fact a reality. So that's what the U.S. has done. But getting to General Cheney's question, what strategic interest does the U.S. have in it, right? Why does the U.S. government care? And I think it's legitimate and it's a fair question. So as a threshold matter, it's important to point out that the U.S. is interested in American companies succeeding abroad, right? So the U.S. government does this in a variety of ways. So whether it's through export promotion, whether it's through trade agreements, export-import financing, OPIC, whose building we're in, OPIC financing as well. The U.S. is involved in many ways. In addition to which, the Department of Commerce has trade officers in embassies throughout the world, and U.S. companies regularly work with embassies and commerce folks in promoting trade. But I think that there really is, so that's the commercial side. There are much deeper, though, much deeper strategic interests that the U.S. has that I think are really fascinating in this space. So first, I think it's critical also to, I know it's been mentioned on the panel previously, but energy is a very special commodity, or the gas, oil, all these commodities are very special. They have historically been used by some countries as a coercive tool. And as a result, you know, Secretary Clinton spoke about this about 4 years ago in a famous speech at Georgetown, or I was going to say in my world, or my very small world, it was a famous speech, where she laid out the need for U.S. diplomacy to engage in energy matters. And Secretary Kerry has pursued this very aggressively in his tenure. But aside from energy's being unique, the Eastern Mediterranean, I think, also presents some very unique aspects. It's an area of the world where regional dynamics, as I'm sure you all know, regional dynamics are very delicately balanced. And if there is an opportunity to deepen or strengthen, let's say, that delicate balance into strong commercial ties, then it's certainly in the U.S.'s interest to ensure that for regional stability. If you think about, well, I should say this. This is not the first time that energy commodities present potential for ensuring regional stability. So in 1951, the Paris Treaty initiates what was really the precursor to the European Union, so the European Coal and Steel Community. And the rationale for that was essentially France and Germany decide that it is in their best interest to cooperate and collaborate on natural resources and on energy commodities than competing against each other. And so as a result, you have what is now today the EU. And so I don't think it is unrealistic to imagine that even in the Eastern Med, which is certainly different than Europe, natural resources and energy resources can play a very similar role. And I'll also point out, aside from, let's say, the historical significance of the Jordan pipeline, I think that the situation in Egypt, which I understand was also discussed earlier today, I'd like to point out as well there, Egypt has gone from being a net energy exporter, and really one of the largest exporters of the time, to being an energy importer, and is in dire need of gas at this point. And again, for political stability, for economic stability, if there is a way that the U.S. government can help facilitate further stability, then that also lines up very squarely within a U.S. strategic interest. But I would say so aside from energy being unique, the Eastern Med being a very delicately balanced and interesting region, the location and the strategic location of the gas finds and the EEZ of both Cyprus and in Israel also are very significant. As my colleague from Noble can probably explain better than I, oil and gas markets are very different. So it's not terribly complicated to put oil onto a barge and send it across the world. When it comes to gas, things are a bit more complex. The infrastructure necessary is fairly sophisticated, LNG import and export terminals, pipelines, and folks in the industry will say, when you sign an oil contract, you're just buying something. When you sign an energy a gas contract, you're getting married. So location matters. Location matters, and they're very long-term contracts. And so that's why the finds in the Eastern Med are very significant for European energy diversity. And I know it has been discussed at some point earlier today as well, but you've got certain countries in the EU who are up to 90-95% reliant on Russian gas. And so if the opportunity presents itself for energy diversity, for supply diversity, then countries would be very interested. And I understand that the Trans-Anatolian pipeline is in process and is bringing Azeri gas into, or will be bringing Azeri gas into southern Europe. But every little bit counts. So it's good for both Israel and Cyprus, the exporters. This would be good for the regional neighbors. So Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, it would further their economic and political stability, and really it's good for Europe. So I'll just conclude by referencing something that I started out saying earlier. This issue really captures the imagination, I think, in a way that other areas of the world and other development of natural resources don't. And like I said, when I had read this report that they were going to theoretically thinking about a pipeline to Egypt, I thought it was just impossible. And so in the same sense that I guess my vision was proven wrong, I do think that we are still at a moment where all the countries in the Eastern Med, so even those we have not discussed, or even Lebanon and Syria, could be interconnected at some point. And so if that is indeed a possibility, even if it does seem fairly remote at this point, I think that the U.S. should do everything it can to support that.
David, great comments. Thank you very much, and you've really set the table for us. I'm going to turn it over to Ben from Noble.
Great, thank you.
And Steve, I think we've got, Matthew, are you good to go with
The slides, right.
The slides, yeah.
So now we're going to take a hard right turn here to corporate America. So I'm going to start with a statement, of course, a disclosure statement. So bear with me. But if you can go to the next slide, please. There it is.
We have to
forward
read that.
Looking. Yes, you do. Can you? And then report out later, Steve. But see, just in a serious sense, of course, there may be some forward-looking statements in my comments today, but please know that there are no assurances that these may be the actual results, and in fact, actual results may differ materially. As well, we just announced our earnings call, which is May 5th. So if you're looking for an update on all things East Med, I would direct you to our website, and you might actually want to join the call because I would imagine there will be some focus on the Eastern Med as far as an update is concerned. So you're always welcome to join those quarterly calls in that regard. So we're done with that, and we'll move on. So we're going to take a little bit of a step back to give you some history, a little bit of numbers and technical scope. Some of you in the room have seen this, these sorts of presentations from Noble often, but we will along the way make some comments that are more back to the noble energy interest in the area that go beyond some facts and figures, but we thought it would be helpful to present to you a little bit of scope. This may be hard to see, just more of a backdrop than anything else as far as my comments are concerned today. But, you know, our commitment to the East Med, as some of you may know, started in 1998. You know, we made a strategic decision to invest in Israel when many others were unwilling to take that risk, and we remain very committed to the region. As the first operator to discover natural gas both offshore Israel and Cyprus, Noble Energy is pleased to be here today with the ASP and all of you to really begin to talk more about why we have an interest in the area and the potential these vast resources provide to both Israel, Cyprus, Jordan, Egypt, and others in the area. So our significant world-class discovery started with the Levant Basin. And I'm not going to do a geologic presentation today, I promise you, but there are many at Noble that would be happy to do so if you're interested in that. But it certainly, whoever would have thought that the Levant Basin would provide an energy security and economic development opportunity for the area. We drilled 11 successful wells and appraisal wells and discovered, as you've heard many times today, more than 40 TCF of natural gas, world-class resources, world-class natural gas, no doubt about it. And I'll say more about just how that's working currently. We delivered the first domestic supply in 2004, and we hope to do the same for Cyprus in the foreseeable future, which is an important development. We have an outstanding operational performance at Tamar, which is the only producing platform in the area or field today, which is currently fueling half of Israel's electrical needs. And as the Israel Electric Corporation has so stated, the use of natural gas is the main factor in reducing electricity prices. And a lot of you have written about this and the economic benefits that Israel is realizing each and every day just from the Tamar field alone. So I won't get into all those numbers. But as we've discussed today, and there's been a lot of press on it, certainly it's mostly starting in December of 2014, quieted down a little bit during the elections. There was a lot of coverage about the fact that we have been hard at it, working with the Israeli government to try to ensure there is a path forward for the Leviathan and expansion of the Tamar project. We've made progress with the government of Israel in creating a framework that achieves many of the things that you've been talking about here today. Regulatory certainty and contract sanctity that will allow the resources to be developed. We look forward to working with the new government of Israel. Certainly its appointments and decisions are made to achieve this outcome. We're also have begun to work with others to try to meet Egypt's near-term demand with an interruptible gas supply opportunity from the Tamar field. Tamar produces, and I'll get more into that, about 1 BCF a day, but certainly Israel doesn't need that each and every day. So there's extra gas in the system. Natural gas, and our current desire and hope is that we can provide that to Egypt and to Jordan in the near future. Next slide. This slide, if we can go to it, again, probably hard to read from back. I didn't realize the screens were so small, so my apologies. And I won't spend a lot of time on it, but Noble's been hard at work in the region since we've been there. A lot of activity. You don't hear a lot about that in the media, and as far as delivering just Tamar and doing the necessary analysis to develop Leviathan, a lot of work has been involved. And this is a timeline that would demonstrate that since our first discovery at NOAA in 1999. Again, we were doing this type of work and this type of investment when really few others would invest in the region, as mentioned, and Israel had little infrastructure to utilize the natural gas But Noble believed in the future and the opportunity and kept moving ahead. In 2009, when we discovered Tamar, it was the largest offshore natural gas field at that time. That just was an amazing moment in history. And we brought Tamar online in 2013, which is in many cases unheard of for these deep water type projects. A lot of first evers very on the technical front that were achieved so that Israel could have a natural gas supply other than Mari B, because Mari B was fast depleting. And there were a lot of issues around that, as you might recall, with regard to meeting their electricity needs. And then came Leviathan, which is twice the size of Tamar, which is even more exciting. And then finally, we, as you see on the timeline, discovered the Aphrodite field, which has already been discussed a lot in Cyprus. And along that timeline, we had a number of other smaller discoveries, which you've probably read about. So if we go on to the next slide, which, again, I've already said a lot about Tamar. It's an amazing example of what can occur when all the pieces come together. And when we made the investment and when we brought it online, and I had the good fortune of visiting Tamar soon after it came online with Chuck Davidson, our then CEO and now chairman of Noble Energy, you could see the pride that the folks that work on the platform, many local Israelis, had in having bringing this natural gas domestic resource to the country in a very safe manner. We're to demonstrate our continued commitment to Israel and to bringing natural gas, even in this environment of regulatory uncertainty, we're hard at work at doing something we call debottlenecking. So there's just some kinks, if you will, in the system, some efficiencies that can be realized that would bring, it's more centered around compression. And here I won't go into a technical background. And yes, I'm a petroleum engineer by degree, so I could go there if we wanted to. But through compression, we think we can bump up Tamar from 1 BCF a day to 1.2 BCF a day. That extra capacity is a good opportunity for Israel and is a good opportunity for the short-term opportunities for Jordan and for Egypt. So that project continues on. And of course, with the environmental benefits that come to Israel from this high-quality natural gas are self-evident. It's just amazing. There are a lot of stats and studies that have been done around that. On to the Leviathan slide, if you would. Here we're looking at 22 TCF, and this is really where I think this field, in addition to Tamar, brought the sort of mindset that David talks about, energy diplomacy. I think, Michael, you were talking about in our early discussions, because of these resources, just some 3 years ago, we were looking at those global markets, because we weren't in the mindset of regional market whatsoever. A lot of work and study and analysis and feed studies were going on around exporting via LNG, especially with a 22 TCF resource sitting in Israel. But things changed, and all of a sudden we were talking about regional opportunities, and that's just in recent time. And those really have taken off on with momentum, and we're hopeful we'll get back on to investing in those projects, and we can, as mentioned, deliver some short-term opportunities rather quickly, especially this interruptible opportunity to Egypt. But to achieve that, we need the government regulators in Israel and to come together, as mentioned by previous speakers, provide that regulatory certainty and government policies that are needed. It matters. A line that we like to use is capital needs confidence, and confidence must be earned. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of recent examples in Israel where we have not achieved that. And to allow these resources to grow, to bring in the investment from others, which we welcome and encourage, We need to address these antitrust issues, permitting issues, and tax issues. There are many, and I won't go through it, but each one of these, as you sort of change the rules of the game, can cause uncertainty and therefore leads to lack of confidence for rather large investments. These projects are not small. They're large capital investments that require others to chip in to make them real, to bring them to fruition. But as mentioned, we're committed to moving Leviathan and working with the Israeli government to implement effective and stable and transparent regulations that will encourage these investments from Noble, from other international oil and gas companies, and other parties. Let's move to Cyprus for a moment. We don't want to forget Cyprus. Next slide. A bit of a smaller field at the moment, from 5 TCF. But there's been some developments on that front. We are working very closely with the Cypriot Ministry of Energy to submit our development plan on the Aphrodite project. It is, even though it's at 5 TCF, it is the third largest discovery in the area at the moment. And it certainly has far greater potential than just to provide meet Cyprus's domestic market needs, especially with all the demand we've talked about in the area. And recently at the Egyptian Investment Conference, which I participated in, Steve was there, of course, at Chamber had a nice session there. EGAS and the CHC, which is a Cypriot hydrocarbon company, held a ceremony where they signed a MOU for a joint technical study to evaluate the pipeline and the facilities needed to deliver this Cypriot gas to Egypt. And we're very encouraged about that, and we're participating in that effort. So, to wrap this up, we look forward to working with the various East Med governments to meet the national and regional demand. And certainly, as it's been said over and over, and David articulated here, is that energy diplomacy can lead to economic security and create diplomatic possibilities. I think this is, yes, there are many examples around the world, but given the nature of this part of the world, certainly best exemplifies that.
Ben, thanks. Fabulous comments and a great compliment to David. Last but not least is Steve Lutz. He's the Director of Middle East and North Africa Affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is four blocks away from here, and I understand that you got held up by, the Iraqi Prime Minister?
Yes.
Not much you can do.
Speaking of the region.
Yeah, speaking of the region. I got held up by him walking over to the CFR 2 days ago. But anyway, now, last but not least, let me turn the floor over to you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation. And we want to applaud the American Security Project for putting this forum on today and the invitation to the chamber. Just to give you, I think most of you are familiar with the U.S. Chamber. And the work that we do on the domestic front, which we're well known for, tax, healthcare, regulatory policy, we do have a very robust international division. It's actually our largest part of the U.S. Chamber, in fact, and that's reflective of where the U.S. business community is, the reality that 95% of the world's consumers live beyond the borders of the United States. And as David mentioned, you know, trade policy, expanding exports, growing commercial activities abroad is certainly a focus of the U.S. private sector, which brings us to where we're at within the chamber and our Middle East team. We have a unique position on this issue, on this discussion, in that we're home to both the U.S.-Israeli Business Council as well as the U.S.-Egypt Business Council. And my counterpart, Josh Cram, who's executive director of the U.S.-Israel Business Council, I actually just spoke to a couple hours ago, and he's in Israel he's working hard on this and doing his work and efforts. And I actually run our Egypt Council at the chamber. So we oftentimes marry our work together on projects like this, and it really does speak to the idea of regional cooperation, greater bilateral work amongst countries in the region, and how the U.S. Business community, the private sector, companies such as Noble are playing a leading role in this. And I do think Noble and what they've done really should be applauded. You know, they've really been a leader when you look at this in the Eastern Med. They've put a lot of capital deployed and invested. They've taken a lot of risk, and they see a huge opportunity. And to their credit, they're there and they're doing the work. So we really do applaud them and all that they're doing there. I think a lot of what I'm going to say is going to echo what my colleagues up here have said, as well as what has probably been said earlier. But at the Chamber, we, through our two different programs, have been very active on this issue, on this opportunity. I know Josh and our Israel Council, for example, has put forth a set of policy recommendations to the Israeli government. I think about a year and a half ago, a detailed paper, but largely discussing the ideas, the themes that have been raised, regulatory certainty, transparency, all that are critically important. And an important point to be made is, while this is in this particular sector, what Israel does in terms of the regulatory regime in this space can have a ripple effect. Other sectors are going to look at what they're doing in terms of regulating energy, regulating these industries, and it if done wrong, it can have a chilling effect. So it's an important, you know, point for the Israelis to do this right, have the regulatory certainty. One thing that we've been talking about is, you know, we're experiencing our own energy boom here in the United States, and if you think about it, there's many of the implications are very similar. For what can happen in Israel in terms of growth and contributions to the GDP, cutting carbon emissions, creating jobs, all the benefits are there. There are some things that we would encourage the Israelis maybe not to necessarily follow what the United States has done. When you look at kind of the patchwork of how the United States regulates the industry, you don't have, you know, kind of an overarching federal regime. You have states that also have their policy, so it's truly a patchwork, and it's quite a maze to have to work through. So that was one of the things that we had suggested in the policy paper, much more articulately. You know, discussing the idea of how you want to have an overarching policy, and you know, based on the idea of certainty. You know, another important point to be made, I think, too, is certainly we. Again, we applaud companies like Noble that are involved in the upstream, but think about the downstream implications. And as I mentioned, I'm very involved in what we do in Egypt and been there frequently. We were just in Sharm el-Sheikh, and we talked to a lot of American companies who are invested in a lot of different sectors, as well as our friends in the Egyptian industry. And you have a lot of industries that require natural gas, energy, that are hurting right now, from the cements to the plastics and the producers, and having a stable supply, not only coming from what you're working on, it can not only bring the countries closer together in terms of energy diplomacy, you can also support, you know, what's going on in terms of other industries in Egypt, which is very important not only to what American companies are doing there in chemicals or plastics or cement, but as well as Egyptians. And, of course, we're all very familiar with the need to, you know, keep the lights on as we go into the summer and keep those air conditioners running. But it's also important to some of these heavy manufacturing industries as well. So it really is a game changer, not only just for Israel, but the potential for the region. And we very much, you know, support this idea of energy diplomacy, of energy cooperation. And, you know, we're working, you know, not only with our friends at Noble and in the U.S. government, but as well as in Israel and in Egypt in particular, but of course in Jordan and the Palestinian territories and in Turkey and elsewhere, to try to move this forward, to move these projects forward, because, you know, we view it as an incredible opportunity, you know, not only for U.S. companies, but also the governments in the region, which need the revenue, which need to create the jobs, and which really need stability. And at the end of the day, if we have a more stable relationship between Israel and their partners, and then on those domestic fronts, it creates a better business environment for more U.S. investment, not only in the energy sector, but across all sectors. So we look at it very much, you know, from the in the weeds issues on these very specific projects, but as well as what it can mean across a number of sectors, as well as the larger relationship. So we're excited about it, we're encouraged by it, and again, we applaud Noble and, of course, this forum for bringing together the conversation.
Well, Steve, thanks. The I mentioned when I opened this conference up this afternoon that this subject fell right into ASB's sweet spot. And I say sweet spot because when we were first created, we took a bunch of military folks and put them on the board and wanted them to talk the national security perspective of other issues like commerce, for instance, or diplomacy. In other words, the answer to every international situation wasn't a military solution. There are other ways to do it. There are better ways to do it. And we can talk the national security side with the military guys. And we think this one falls right into that bailiwick. So that said, everybody's familiar with what's gone on, and this is unrelated, the Iran negotiations and that whole business. However, Netanyahu and his strong opposition to it and the relationship with Israel now, it's a little bit tense, I think. And has that bled over at all into this environment, into the energy side of the house, or do you see any impact of that on working with Israel on the energy commerce side? Ah, no takers.
They're all in the, Well, from Noble's perspective, no. I mean, our conversations have been ongoing from on both the U.S. government side and the Israeli government side. So, you know, certainly the elections there probably had more of an impact than this matter. But that's, again, from a pure
Noble...
But
now with the elections over,
right?
Does it smooth the pathway a little bit?
Well, we're hopeful that the certainty that will come from the elections will result in certainty on the regulatory front.
So nobody from Israel is holding us hostage, per se, to any Iran negotiations as a consequence of doing anything on the energy side of the house, I would hope. In other words, they're not saying, hey, you get an agreement with Iran, and we're not going to deal with you on the energy side.
Noble's not involved in any of those.
No, I certainly have not heard that, but I'll just echo what Ben had mentioned. I mean, I think one of the challenges in pursuing the certainty that Ben is talking about was the fact that whenever the Prime Minister called for new elections, right, he essentially disbanded his cabinet, and then the energy minister became someone who everyone knew was on his way out. And so there's been a prolonged period, is it since November, when the Prime Minister called for new elections, where there's been just uncertainty about who in the government should be that appropriate address. And even now that elections have taken place, they have not identified the coalition, nor have they identified the various ministers. And so, you know, the relevant ministers here would be the Minister of Energy, would be the Minister of the Economy, and so folks just don't really know who those people are. So I think that uncertainty is playing more of a role than anything that might be happening behind the scenes that I'm not aware of on the Iran front.
Interesting. If it takes as long to confirm their cabinet members as it does here, it could take a while. Be a long wait.
Right.
Well, at least there's some hope down the line. Ben, what Noble's done, I think, is really interesting. It's an education for us here at ASP, and no doubt it's a security issue from our perspective, in that the more trade you have, the better relationships you have. You solidify relationships across all sectors, and it just improves everything dramatically. So appreciate that. With that, let me open up to any questions you all might have here in the audience. I don't see 100 hands going up, but I will grab the young man out here to my left. You're right down there. Please identify yourself and hopefully have a short question.
My name is Yosef Brahe from Ethiopian Press Group. When we mention Egypt, we find Egypt as the intersection of Africa, Middle East, Arab, Mediterranean. So my question is on the other energy source, water. Now, Egypt depends on Nile, for irrigation, water, energy, and a lot of things. The upstream countries on Nile now, they try to take their stake, including Ethiopia. That affects Israel, and what the U.S. and the American government try to help on the Nile countries to cooperate in the energy? Maybe for Steve?
I'm not sure I heard that question entirely. Do you want to cooperate in energy? You mentioned water.
My question is like, what U.S. and U.S. companies can do on cooperating Nile countries on the energy?
On energy.
Yeah. And the other question is the Nile affect Israel?
Any takers on Chamber of Commerce, perhaps?
You mentioned water in the Nile, and if I remember right, if I recall right, I think President Sisi was just meeting with some of the corresponding countries that are impacted by that, and those heads of state. And I'm just trying to recollect from news clippings that I've seen, but I think they've came to some semi-agreement on, you know, the flow of the water and whatnot. So I think that's a positive step for Egypt and the neighbors if they're talking and coming to agreement on how to control that and have that flow. You know, in terms of other waterways, I mean, the Suez Canal, obviously, major expansion going on there in Egypt, but that's off subject, and I know that there's several American companies involved in that.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just point out that I think you're right. You're right to suggest that there is this connection between energy and water. And one of the things that the U.S. government has been involved with, and that I know several governments in North Africa and the Middle East are very focused on, is desalination. And that process, of course, is very energy intensive. And so, you know, countries in the Gulf that are very energy resource rich are almost entirely now on desal. Folks closer to, let's say, where we are, you know, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, it's much more of a challenge. But there are, you know, research and development efforts that are underway. And I guess that's not directly to your Nile point. But the energy water nexus is real. And as far as U.S. companies are concerned, aside from the Chamber of Commerce, I think your previous position was at the Commerce Department.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. Commerce Department has export assistance centers all across the country that help facilitate U.S. involvement in foreign markets.
Andrew?
Thanks. Great panel and great discussion. Thanks, guys. So my question is about how active State Department has been in this. And I know they have been, and I should mention that we invited Amos Hochstein to be a part of this today, and he wanted to, but he's out of town. I think he's in Turkey, actually, right now. I think I saw that on Twitter. It has been quite interesting to me to see how active State has been on this and how they've really taken this up. I wonder if you could comment on that. And is this kind of notable that they're doing this, and is it helpful?
David, you want to
take that?
Sure.
David?
I'd be happy to. If there are others would want to comment on you know, private sector perception of it, I'd be curious as well. From I guess, and I should just preface this by saying this is my own perspective, right? This is not necessarily that of, right, our entire energy committee. But I think it's been incredibly helpful. And this was an issue that, let's say, 4 years ago, certain members of Congress focused on. My old boss, Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, was very engaged on this issue. And when she initially mentioned this to various folks within the administration, you know, the Commerce Department thought it was interesting, but really not that feasible. But State Department actually said, this is fantastic. This is a great idea. My thought is, I guess, they similarly saw that there was this very significant potential, as I had referenced earlier, both on the regional side, but also, you know, continental Europe side. And there was also a limit to how much Congress could really be doing, because things are a bit more public when members of Congress travel. But when you have folks from the State Department, like Special Envoy Hochstein, you know, he can travel around. People don't really know who he is. Now that may be changing, though, if he has his Twitter account. I think that to their credit, so both Hochstein and Secretary Kerry and others from the State Department have been very effective. I know the U.S. embassies all in the region have been very engaged, all over the Eastern Mediterranean. And at least from where I sit, I think that they're able to do things that others within the government, you know, Congress included, are just not able to. So I see it as a significant net positive.
Steve, you concur?
Yeah, I would definitely I would agree with that. And looking at it with my Egypt hat on, we've seen, of course, we were without a U.S. ambassador in Cairo for some time, and we were fortunate in that Ambassador David Thorne, as you know, special assistant to the secretary, really played the role as, in many respects, the kind of the special envoy to Egypt, and he was carrying a lot of the water and doing a lot of the work on a whole host of U.S.-Egypt issues, but. You know, this issue certainly, you know, he's been engaged in, and others at the State Department. So we would echo and agree that they've been quite active on it, and it's been helpful. There was a large presence in Sharm el-Sheikh, and I know, you know, this subject was certainly on many people's minds. And the Secretary was there, Ambassador David Thorne was there, our now Ambassador Stephen Beecroft, and several from State. So they've been quite active on it.
We know David well, and he was one of our original board members at ASP and started this organization. And yeah, just a great fan. And you would think, some would say, well, let me figure this out. The State Department's in favor of drilling for gas in the Mediterranean Sea. And they'd go, what's wrong with this picture? But I think clearly they understand the value to it and what it's provided in the Middle East and the stability and recognize it. I don't think that message is across the country to understand what a value this is. To not just international stability, to our own country and our own commerce. So
I'll just add to that, in the sense from a Noble's perspective, our engagement on the U.S. government side is solely focused on sound energy policy and diplomacy. And as far as we're concerned, and including the State Department, it really has become, in the Eastern Mediterranean, a bipartisan issue. And that is truly, you know, I think is making a difference.
A minor miracle in this day and age.
To economic security.
That's for sure. Right. Any, yes, sir. Sir Michael.
Thank you very much. Great panel. Just a small quibble with David, or rather a plea. I think the arguments in favor of developing Eastern Mediterranean gas are so strong that they should be argued on their own merits and not invoking European energy security, because there really is no scenario for the time being for this gas to reach European markets, neither by LNG nor by pipeline. Yeah, I mean, it's a strong temptation, particularly by politicians, to invoke this possibility. But really, I mean, perhaps one day, you know, if this gas goes to Egypt, if those LNG plants export to Europe, seems unlikely, but you never know. And the pipeline projects that have been mooted, I think, have been shown to be technically and commercially not viable for the time being. So I think this energy has its inherent value for the companies concerned, for the region, for Israel, for Cyprus, and so on. But I don't see it in the foreseeable future supplying the European market.
Right. No, I think it's a fair point, and I could even argue it even a little stronger. Which is that if you look at the net amount we're talking about, it's really not that significant, right? So if you combine what's in, you know, Israeli EEZ and the Cypriot EEZ, it's approximately what, 35, less than 40 TCF, right? And if you just put that on the scale of what we talk about in other countries, so Qatar, for example, has got the equivalent of roughly, you know, 900 TCF, right? So Eastern Med versus Qatar is about 4%, right? So it's fairly insignificant. That said, to what I mentioned earlier, even though things seem, you know, technically not feasible at this point, I remember sitting in a meeting with Israeli government officials and members of Congress, and there was a plan on the table to build a pipeline to Greece from Israel, which is completely off the table. And even at the time, folks were very skeptical of that, and I think that there were some kind of political reasons why they were even exploring that. And certainly there was discussion of, you know, pipeline up to Turkey. But I think that even if now it is not technically feasible, I think that it's still just important to point out that it's part of this larger conversation and the larger potential, but a fair point.
And David, to bring in the technical piece of that, as we've talked to you and to Michael and others, is, of course, as we looked at the technical capabilities or challenges of putting in these pipelines, for those that don't know, this is a very challenging environment. What I mean that on the seafloor is, as we've talked about, is mountains and valleys, and it's very expensive. It requires some of the best technology and steel, if you will, on the market. So these are expensive propositions from a technology standpoint. Frankly, for no matter what direction you go, but certain directions have more of those challenges, Greece being one of them from a technical perspective.
Interesting. Great comment. Yes, ma'am, always.
Hi. Also, thank you. This has been really insightful. My question, I guess, is for a little bit of everyone, but Mr. Dillon, you mentioned that Noble is looking into this pipeline from Cyprus to Egypt, and I know that that's a project that's been discussed for a bit of time.
Right.
Egypt, I read in a report recently, is absolutely diversifying its energy that it's getting from all over the place, but they're also trying to be energy independent, I think I saw, by 2020. I have two questions. One, is that feasible? Is that actually possible? And two, does that factor into any business or any of the Department of Commerce or any place else? Is that something that is part of the calculus?
I'll take the first stab at from a Noble perspective. Certainly our participation in the Egypt Investment Conference encouraged us about the willingness and the business desire to bring in EastMed gas. And certainly the fact that at the moment, you know, this feasibility study on the Cyprus side will help us better understand. But first look recently says that that could be an economic opportunity, meaning that you can get the pipeline, unlike maybe to other areas there, in a cost-effective manner that would encourage other investment from others. And of course, in all of these projects, we need investment from others. We want investment from others to manage the risk associated with it. So from a Noble perspective, we are seeing much greater interest from business parties in Egypt to bring this gas to Egypt sooner rather than later. And I think even though from our perspective, yes, other gas, local domestic gas opportunities are being discovered and looked at, certainly this supplements that, and these resources are already discovered and declared, right? So they're there. And we know the 40 TCF is in place. And if we can get through the regulatory, achieve the regulatory certainty, I mean, we're ready to move these projects and move ahead until we greatly limited our investments the first of this year once this uncertainty occurred. But so I think my sense from a Noble perspective that this is a more of a short-term opportunity, certainly on the interruptible basis to Egypt from the Tamar platform, as mentioned, but as well, since these gas reserves are already proven, even in the, I'll call it, foreseeable future. You know, these typical offshore projects like this take, remember these, for Leviathan and Cyprus, there's no Tamar platform sitting there. It's just the few wells that have been drilled to prove up the reserves, to meet all the requirements to do so. So now you have to build all the infrastructure, all of that. Those are the, and that's what we call it cold stacked, certainly on the Leviathan Tamar side. We haven't got that far on the Cyprus side. But even if we say we recommenced all of that, you know, these type of deep water projects, just to get the infrastructure in place for either Cyprus or Leviathan, you know, the numbers are, they range because of a variety of factors, but certainly 4, 5, 6 years to just get the infrastructure in place to begin to deliver that first molecule. But even at that, that's still probably maybe compared to other opportunities in the Egyptian, say, area, maybe at the front end of that timeline. So that's probably driving some of that interest.
I would just say Egypt has definitely ambitious goals, and President Sisi definitely has a vision, and you know, we think he's assembled a pretty technocrat, diverse cabinet of people, including the Minister of Investment, Ashraf Salomon, and the Minister of Trade, Abdel Noor, and others who, you know, we think are going to be hopefully effective in helping them move their vision forward. And they certainly are looking to diversify, you know, not only their energy supply, but their economy. And they're, you know, they're looking to build out, you know, not only heavy industry, but some of the knowledge-based sectors like healthcare and ICT. But again, we keep coming back to do all of that, you know, that you have to be able to keep the lights on. You have to have power. So, you know, these opportunities to have this regional cooperation, if you think about it, it's really an underpinning for all of their plans. So if they're going to become a regional hub in any of these other sectors and really grow them effectively, they're going to need to have the energy capability to do so.
I know I keep highlighting the interruptible gas matter, but again, why? For the reason Steve said, is it's ready available gas to go to Egypt through the EMG gas pipeline. It's already there. And we believe strongly that if regulatory certainty can be achieved, we can move that gas rather rapidly. Yes, that has to occur on both sides here, and there are a lot of issues around that some discussed today that aren't noble issues, but that it would send the right signal for the needed capital from others, including Noble, for the Leviathan and Tamar projects. So we're very quite focused on that at the moment.
And I'll just point out, as a general matter, I would say countries around the world are obviously very focused on renewables, and even in the U.S., there's a lot more that we can be doing. But there's an organization called IRENA, the International Renewable Energy Agency. And in fact, every country that we're talking about in the Eastern Mediterranean, except for one, is a member of IRENA. And I won't embarrass that country and call them out. You can find it on your own. But all countries are focused on renewables, right? And even focusing on the Western Med, you know, you've got Morocco, who has very ambitious renewable goals, but is also exploring offshore as well. And so the way that some think about gas and, you know, Chamber of Commerce and Noble May is, you know, gas really is this, can be viewed as a transition fuel, right? So Jordan, for example, shifted all of their power plants, or most of their power plants, to natural gas because it was much cleaner than diesel. Given the interruption, though, from Egypt into Jordan, they've had to convert back now to diesel-powered generation, and it has a significant impact on the environment. There's a great statistic that Noble has about the immediate environmental impact of transitioning, or when Tamar came online, and Israel primarily was fired by coal-fired power plants. And when they shifted from coal to natural gas, it was the equivalent of what? Taking all the cars off of the roads of Israel for a decade.
Yeah, we use another stat, David, about Tamar has the potential to take 195 million metric tons of CO2 emissions out of the air,
right,
alone, which is amazing.
Which is
another way to look at it.
Yeah, which is really an amazing statistic. But I guess my thought is energy is constantly evolving. And so it's the role of the U.S. government certainly to encourage renewable energy, and that's what we're doing in various capacities. But the reality is, you know, natural gas is here, and we want to make sure that it's used appropriately.
Yeah, the American Security Project has long viewed gas as the bridge fuel to come across, and it's the quick answer, and it's the much, much better answer than burning coal. Coal is just nasty, nasty stuff. And if you, you know, when look at China that's building a coal-fired plant, every 2 weeks now. You would much rather have them burning natural gas than you would want them burning anything else. So,
and or importing heavy oil fields, right?
It's just
coal,
really
in play in diesel in Israel, right?
You bet.
That's right.
You bet. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've been very patient and you've hung in there today. I want to thank my panel, you know, Steve, David, Ben.
Yeah, thank you.
I realized late in the afternoon, but you really put on a great presentation. I was thrilled by it. We've got another big event coming at ASP tomorrow on TTIP and TPP. For those who might be interested, same time, same place, different actors. And please hit our website. And please hit our website and give a big round of applause to our panelists.